So this is actually like the 11th year that I've kindly agreed to do this lecture. And it changes a little bit year to year. But it's mostly the same because a lot of the core principles we're going to talk about don't change much. So my name's Paul. I'm a pathologist here. More specifically, I'm a dermatopathologist. So my area of clinical and academic sort of expertise per se is skin disease. But I used to also do a fair amount of thoracic pathology. So you'll see that a fair number of the examples of cases that I show today are actually from the realm of thoracic disease and pathology. So buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be an adrenaline-fueled ride through histopathology. We're going to talk about pathology sort of broadly to start. What is it? What's the path department do? I know most of you are sort of master's or PhD students. You probably have some variable experience with clinical medicine, so hopefully some of this isn't too big a repetition for you. We'll talk about the tools that pathologists use, and for the most part I'm talking about anatomic pathology, and I'll clarify that in a second. We'll talk about some, and this is the kind of the really boring part, some of the definitions and concepts that are very important in pathology. We'll talk about how a pathologist approaches a specimen, whether that's a biopsy or a big surgical resection or something. We'll talk about, generally, how we classify cancer, this being a cancer hospital, that's one of our big focuses, right? And then we'll talk about how we actually recognize cancer. What is it about the cells of cancer that allow us to say that's malignant or that's not malignant, that's benign? Two very important concepts in cancer treatment are grade and stage, and people tend to get those a little bit confused sometimes, so hopefully we can clarify that and prevent future confusion. Finally, we'll go over some newer changes in pathology. I mean, this is a field that has evolved dramatically since I first got involved. And we'll also talk about how pathology applies to research and might apply to your career going forward. So the old standard kind of dictionary definitions of pathology are these. It's fundamentally the study of the nature of disease and how it changes the body, right? These are changes that are anatomic, and that's a lot of what I do is look at the anatomic changes, or physiologic. And pathology is in the unique situation of being a connection between the big wide world of clinical medicine, whether that's surgery or radiation oncology, and the big wide world of research medicine. And these words are all really small, but they say things like biochemistry and molecular biology and other stuff, pharmacology and experimental therapeutics. But pathology is a bridge between those groups of disciplines. Because we talk to the surgeons about their specimens and we go to clinical tumor boards and help the clinical team make decisions, but at the same time, we are in charge of and own the tissue that researchers need, and we have a better understanding of many of the kind of basic science principles that apply to cancer than many other clinicians do. So that's why pathologists are that kind of bridge. So a department of pathology like we have here at Roswell has sort of a number of different arms. I work primarily in the anatomic pathology arm, and I'll discuss that in a second. Clinical pathology is a very important part of a well-rounded pathology department, too. And then, of course, there's the side of pathology that is involved in research, and that's tissue procurement, translational research that my colleagues and I do, and there's some pathologists here at Roswell that actually have their own wet labs that do that kind of research. Anatomic pathology, in turn, I wonder how long it's going to be before I accidentally step off the stage while I'm talking here. I tend to wander, so. So anatomic pathology can be sort of divided into surgical pathology, cytopathology, and autopsy pathology. Autopsies, despite kind of how pathology is portrayed in the media, are actually a fairly minor component of what most pathology departments do, especially these days. Autopsies used to be far more frequent. But at Roswell here, in an average year, we only maybe do 23-24 autopsies. So, you know, a couple a month. They're really not. I haven't personally overseen one in, I don't know, like 2 or 3 years. So, but what most of us do here at Roswell is surgical pathology. And that's looking at either biopsy specimens to diagnose cancer or resection specimens where they're removing the cancer. For example, they take out a lobe of lung or a lobe of liver or do a partial colectomy for a colon cancer. And all of those specimens route through our pathology department, and you'll see why in a few minutes. Another important part of surgical pathology is frozen section. Now, normally, as you'll see, when we process a specimen and we want to look at it under the microscope, it goes through this overnight process, lots of chemicals and stains. It's really too long a process to be useful to a surgeon who's in the operating room trying to make a decision. So frozen sections allow us to take a piece of tissue, freeze it on the spot, cut a slide of the frozen tissue, stain it, and give the surgeon a reasonably good diagnosis within about 20 minutes. So we have our frozen section room is staffed anytime the operating rooms are active so that if the surgeon needs to know, is this lymph node positive for cancer? We'll freeze it, we'll look at it, we'll say yes or no. What is this little bump I just found on the peritoneal wall? Is that cancer? We'll freeze it, we'll tell. And those results impact the course of the operation. If they don't impact the course of the operation, the surgeon shouldn't be asking for a frozen section. Another big part of anatomic pathology is cytopathology. So these are things like pap smears. The difference between cytopathology and surgical pathology is that whereas in surgical pathology, we're looking at whole pieces of tissue. So we see the cells, we see how they're arranged relative to each other and relative to the other tissue. In cytopathology, they're looking at cells that have broken off, exfoliated, been smeared. So we no longer have that intact tissue architecture. And so cytopathology really focuses on how the individual cells look. This also includes things like aspirates, washes, and brushes. If you have a lump in your thyroid, they might stick a needle in, suck some of the cells out, spray them on a slide, and look at them and tell you, well, I think you have papillary thyroid carcinoma. That would be a fine needle aspirate. Clinical pathology, this other huge branch of pathology that we're really not going to talk about much today, involves a lot of different things. It involves hematology, blood chemistry, microbiology, cultures, that kind of thing. Transfusion medicine. I just came from a lecture by a transfusion medicine faculty candidate here, so they were talking about sickle cell disease and transfusion reactions that can be fatal in sickle cell patients. All of these disciplines fall within a department of pathology, so the physicians that oversee these laboratories are pathologists. And in fact, if you are a pathologist, there's two separate board exams you could take. So you could be board certified in clinical pathology or board certified in anatomic pathology or board certified in both. So let's just kind of clarify a typical kind of clinical scenario and how the pathologist is involved. Let's say a gentleman, 65, 20-pack-year smoking history, starts to cough a lot. Sometimes he's coughing up a little bit of blood. So he goes to his family doctor and says, Doc, I'm coughing up blood. So they send him for a chest x-ray. And he's got this mass in the upper lobe of his lung. And they send him for a CT scan and a PET scan. And it confirms that there really is a mass there and it's metabolically active in the PET scan. So that's a sign that it could be cancer. So they send him to a thoracic surgeon. The thoracic surgeon looks at all the scans and says, yeah, this looks like it could be cancer, especially since you've been smoking for 20-pack years. But we don't know that it's cancer until a pathologist looks at a piece of that tumor. So they'll do a biopsy. If it's sort of, you know, in the right spot, they can just kind of stick a needle in between the ribs and core out a piece of that tumor. And they send it to the pathologist. And the pathologist looks at it under the microscope and says, yes, this is squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. Well, then, they do a bunch of other things to find out as well as they can how far advanced the tumor is at that point. If it's just confined to the lung, then they might go and just cut out that lobe of lung. That specimen, the resection specimen, again goes to the pathologist. In this case, the pathologist is confirming the diagnosis, checking to make sure that the surgeon has removed the whole thing, looking for lymph nodes in other parts of the specimen that will help us stage the tumor, and we'll talk more about that, about staging later, as I said. And then potentially, the pathologist will oversee molecular testing of the tumor to find out if there are any molecular targets that might aid in therapy or in classifying the tumor. And this is the whole sort of flow chart of how the pathologist is involved in cancer care. So how do we do this stuff? Well, it all starts kind of at what we call the grossing station. So we get a biopsy or we get a lobe of lung or something, and somebody has to describe it, what it looks like. Okay, this is a lobe of lung. It measures 8 by 4 by 3 centimeters. And then cut it up, dissect it, and choose which parts of that lobe of lung are going to get put onto glass to be looked at under the microscope. Because this is a, you know, sizable thing. It's not practical to look at all of it under the microscope. So that happens in the grossing station, and they take pieces of tissue and they put them in these, like, here's a piece of tissue. This is, well, okay, here's a game. Does anybody know what this is? Any guesses? It's a finger. It's a finger that's been sliced because it has this on the end of it, which I think even those of us with little or no medical training can probably guess is not normal on the end of your finger. So they've amputated the finger here. This is where the surgeon cut through. The pathologist has sliced this. Okay, so that happened on the grossing table. They take a piece of that tissue and they put them in these cassettes. Now, this is not to scale. These cassettes are only about like this big. But the cassettes have these little holes in them. And those cassettes then get put into a machine like this. This machine sucks all the water out, and through a series of solutions of alcohols and xylene, they remove all the water out and eventually replace it with paraffin wax. So the paraffin wax is liquid when it's hot, and when it cools, it is solid, right? So then they take that piece of tissue and they put it in more paraffin wax, which is what they do here. They use these little kind of heated platforms and stuff to keep the paraffin wax from melting when they don't want it, starting from hardening when they don't want it to harden. And then they cut 5 micron thick sections of that tissue in wax. So this is a really thin strip of a whole bunch of sections they're cutting. They use little paint brushes to pull them off there. And then it's those sections that get laid gently on a slide and stained. Okay? So that's this is the process here. The fixation, it goes in formalin, then it processes in those machines, they cut the sections, and then they do the hematoxylin and ESN stain. The H&E stain is kind of the foundation, the fundamental stain that we use in pathology. So hematoxylin stains the nuclei, it stains acidic materials, and it stains them kind of purpley blue. And then the ESN stains the cytoplasmic contents, and it stains them pink. So here's an H&E. We've got a tumor over here. You can see that the nuclei are all kind of purpley. And I'm sure you've all seen H&Es right before. And we've got some inflammatory cells over there. But that's a typical H&E. But we have other tools, too. We don't just rely on the H&E. The H&E is an incredibly powerful, quick, and cheap way to learn a lot about tissue. But it has its limitations. So we can look at cytogenetics. We used to use electron microscopy a fair bit in pathology. We don't use it much anymore. It's sort of slowly, it's just not relevant in most areas. They still use it in renal pathology sometimes. But immunohistochemistry, and I know probably so many of you are familiar with that from your research work. We can learn a lot about a cell using immunohistochemistry. Because what we're doing is looking for specific antigens in the cell, right? And some of those antigens are on the surface, some of them are in the nuclei, some of them are in the cytoplasm, and we can use those antigens to tell us all sorts of things about what's going on. The basic premise here, as you're probably aware, is that we're using antibodies that are conjugated to biotin, the B vitamin. Biotin has this very strong affinity for avidin, which is from eggs, egg whites. So you basically are creating this connection between the antigen, the antibody that's connected to biotin, and then the biotin then is attaching to the avidin, and then we use that in turn is conjugated to a peroxidase enzyme. So then you've got this
slide with the antibody all over it, attached only where the antigen is present. You put in the reagent to the peroxidase, which is DAB. It's diamino something bevavidine. I don't remember. But anyway, it's DAB. And if the antigen is present, it turns brown. So what do we use it for? This is just a short list of some of the things we use it for. We can confirm the source of a tumor. If somebody has a tumor in a lymph node, we don't know where it came from, and they've done CT scans and PET scans, it's still not clear. We can use immunohistochemistry to sort of interrogate those cancer cells and see what patterns they show, and that can tell us potentially where that tumor is coming from. We can use immunohistochemistry to increase our sensitivity in looking for tumors. So melanoma is one of the things that I work on a lot. And one of the most important prognostic findings in melanoma is whether it has spread to the lymph nodes. So we do a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And even if a couple melanoma cells are present in that huge lymph node, it has prognostic importance. But it can be hard to see those on an H&E, one or two cells among millions of white blood cells that are just normally in the lymph node, right? But if we use immunohistochemistry for a melanocyte-specific antigen, like melan A, those cells are brown and they stand out. And I'll show you sort of, you know, how they stand out in a second. We can use immunohistochemistry to help predict the behavior of something. Malignant tumors tend to be very proliferative, right? The cells are deregulated, they're proliferating out of control. So we can look for antigens that mark cells that are in the proliferative phase of the cell cycle, like this Ki-67 is one such antigen. It's also known as MIB-1. And then we can identify therapeutic targets with immunohistochemistry. The classic example is looking for the estrogen receptor in breast cancer. And the patients that have breast cancers that are expressing, you know, that have the estrogen receptors are potentially patients that would benefit from tamoxifen therapy. Here's an example of how we might use immunohistochemistry to help us figure out where a tumor came from. So we talked about this patient, theoretical patient with a positive lymph node, unknown primary tumor. Well, we can get a good start in narrowing down the differential just with two immunohistochemical stains, CK7 and CK20. Now, these are cytokeratin stains. Cytokeratins, you may remember, are intermediate filaments, part of the cytoskeleton, and they're found in epithelial cells, generally. So if we think this tumor is an epithelial tumor, a carcinoma, we do a 7 and a 20. If it's 7 positive and 20 negative, that sort of helps us exclude some of these other types of cancers, and we could say, okay, well, it's most likely lung, breast, endometrial, you know, a few of these. So it allows us to narrow the differential considerably. And then we can do some other stains to narrow it even further. So we think, okay, maybe this is a lung cancer. Well, we'll do a stain called TTF1, thyroid transcription factor 1. I know it says thyroid in the name, but it's actually fairly specific for lung and thyroid. So that helps us narrow it down, too. If it's TTF1 positive, CK7 positive, CK20 negative, it's making a strong case that it could be a lung cancer. So you see how that works, right? Because we may not be able to tell just by looking at the H&E. Here's a case I had years ago. It was a woman who had a history of breast cancer, lobular breast cancer. And she presented with an endometrial tumor, so in her uterus. And the question was, well, it's kind of a funny-looking tumor to be primary to the uterus, to be a primary endometrial carcinoma. She's had this breast cancer. Let's see if it stains with a breast cancer antigen, in this case something called mammoglobin. Well, you can see that these tumor cells turned brown. That mammoglobin antigen was there. And so this was further proof that this was, in fact, for breast cancer metastasizing to her uterus rather than a primary uterine tumor. Immunohistochemistry, though, is not perfect, obviously. And there are plenty of pitfalls that you need to be aware of when you're using it as a tool. So pathologists are very well versed in this. But we, you know, we still get fooled. You can have false negatives. The antigen you're looking for might not be there, might be degraded. Sometimes your antibody's just no good. Somebody left it out on the counter overnight, or it's too dilute, or it's just past its due date, its expiration date. You can also have false positive reactions.
You can have nonspecific binding. There can be entrapped normal cells in with the tumor, and you think you're looking at tumor that's staining, but it's actually the background normal cells. Sometimes the tumors will actually take up antigens from normal cells, too. So there's a lot of ways that the staining can mislead you. And it's really never the case that the immunohistochemistry is a pure yes or no definitive answer. It tends to provide you with data points that you take in the context of the H&E findings and the clinical findings and the radiology, and you put the whole picture together.
All right, so here's the boring part I promised you about. Some definitions. Now, these are common terms that we use in pathology, and you know, if you're going to be reading pathology literature or talking to clinicians, it's useful to know as precisely as possible what all of these things mean. Purely speaking, tumor is just a swelling. So just because something's a tumor doesn't mean it's malignant, right? It basically just means it's a mass of some kind. Cancer, however, is something that has a fatal course and this tendency to form additional tumors, secondary tumors, what we call metastatic tumors. It's really one of the hallmarks of cancer. Now, not all cancers will metastasize often. The most common cancer in humankind, does anybody know what that is? Squamous cell? That's close. Basal cell carcinoma of the skin. It's the most common tumor in humankind. Basal cell carcinoma doesn't really like to metastasize. It can. If you let it grow to, you know, the size of a grapefruit on your arm or your back or something, it's probably going to metastasize at some point. But you really have to ignore it for a long time, generally, for basal cell to metastasize. But it still has that potential, and that's one of the inherent characteristics of malignancy in cancer. So when epithelium becomes malignant, that's what we call carcinoma, right? So epithelium is derived from the ectoderm or the endoderm, if you're thinking from an embryologic standpoint. And these are the cells that form protective, absorptive, and secretory functions in the body. So they line the outside of the body as your skin. They line the inside of your body as the lining of the colon or the lining of your esophagus, the lining of your mouth. And epithelium then can be divided into all sorts of different types depending on what its function is. So, for example, squamous epithelium is what you have on your skin and in the lining of the cervix. Glandular epithelium is what you might have in the lining of your colon because that has a more absorptive or secretory function, whereas squamous epithelium is primarily sort of a protective epithelium. So here's an epithelium. I don't remember what kind of epithelium this is. It's not a normal epithelium, but you can see that these kind of round to cuboidal cells are piling up on each other a bit. So that's an epithelial surface. Below that, we have stroma, we have blood vessels, we have collagen. And what connects an epithelium to the underlying tissue that it lines or covers is the basement membrane. Now, it's hard to see here, but there's a very thin pink layer along there, and that's the basement membrane. So epithelial cells always sit and are anchored by a basement membrane, which is a mix of proteins and proteoglycans and all sorts of stuff. It's a complex structure, really. So when other tissue types, mesenchymal tissues, non-epithelial tissues, become cancer, that's what we usually call sarcoma. So these are derived from the mesoderm. And these are the connective tissues, so to speak. So cartilage, blood vessels, muscle, bone, these are all mesenchymal tissues. So when you have a cancer arising from those, it's a sarcoma, which is different from a carcinoma by virtue of the tissue that it comes from. Neoplasia is any new or abnormal growth. Usually when we say that, we're talking about a clonal growth, cells that are all derived from the same genetic clone. Of course, a neoplasm is a mass which persists and grows independently of its structures and has no physiologic use. These are some important terms. Metaplasia. So metaplasia is a change in the cells in a tissue to a form that's not normally present in that organ. And I'm going to show an example in a second. Now, usually, metaplasia occurs as a protective response to something. Okay, so the example that I will show is something called Barrett's esophagus. Barrett's esophagus is a replacement of the normal squamous cells of your esophagus with intestinal cells.
And the reason that happens is when you have chronic acid reflux up into your esophagus from your stomach. Your esophagus does not like that. It wants something to protect itself. So it starts to form these intestinal-type cells which secrete mucus and things, and it protects the esophagus a little bit from all that acid coming up. Here's our example. This is an endoscopy. So they're putting a scope down somebody's esophagus. A normal esophagus looks like this on the left. Very kind of uniform, smooth, squamous lining. Okay? It looks a bit like sort of moist skin. On the right, we have Barrett's esophagus, or Barrett's metaplasia. Now, it's a little confusing because the metaplastic part, intestinal, is actually the pinker stuff that looks a bit like this. The normal in this picture is the pale. And so when Barrett's esophagus occurs, they describe it as having a salmon color endoscopically. Before we go on with Barrett's, let me just say one more thing. Hyperplasia is an increase in the number of cells, but they're normal cells for that organ. So if we just had a whole lot of extra squamous cells in the esophagus, that wouldn't be metaplasia, that would be hyperplasia, because those are normal cells for the esophagus. Okay? Here's what Barrett's esophagus looks like histologically. And I should have said, if you have questions, just let me know, please. So here's our normal squamous, thick, protective epithelium. It looks kind of like it should have no problem with a little bit of acid. It's big and thick and kind of robust looking, but it's really not designed for that. And you can see that it sort of stops, and you have this epithelium here, which looks very different. And this is an intestinal type epithelium. And you can see these sort of blue-gray blobs in there. You see those? Those are goblet cells, and that blue-gray stuff is mucus. So they're producing mucus, which covers the surface of the epithelium and protects the esophagus. Okay, so that's metaplasia. Now, the word invasion is used a lot when we talk about cancer. And probably in the purest sense, what we're talking about when we say invasion is that an epithelial tumor, a carcinoma, has penetrated through the basement membrane. So before an epithelial tumor goes through the basement membrane, we say it's in situ. So it's carcinoma in situ. It's still where it belongs, but those cells are carcinoma cells. When it goes through the basement membrane, then it's invasion. And it's an invasive carcinoma. And that's a big deal because carcinomas that have not gone through the basement membrane, they don't yet have any metastatic potential. When they invade through, then they get access to blood vessels and nerves and all sorts of stuff that they can get into and spread through the body. Now, we also use the term invasion sometimes, or actually frequently, just to describe any kind of tumor that's pushed itself into somewhere it doesn't belong, whether that's another organ or a different part of the same organ. It's growing in an irregular way into somewhere where it shouldn't belong. So here's an invasive squamous carcinoma. The normal epithelium is up top here, and there really isn't much basement membrane anymore. And you can see how the tumor cells have sort of pushed in this irregular way down into the underlying stroma here. The basement membrane is pretty much obliterated. So this is a tumor that would potentially have metastatic potential. Another term we use a lot in pathology is differentiation. This tumor is well differentiated or poorly differentiated. And really, we're just talking about how well that tumor recapitulates the cells, the normal tissues from which it's derived. And this is sort of the same thing as grade, which we'll talk about later. A well-differentiated tumor is considered sort of low grade. And in a way, it's an effort to try and predict how aggressive something's going to be. If something's low grade and well differentiated, it's probably not going to be as aggressive and as likely to spread and kill you as something that's poorly differentiated or high grade. This is a well-differentiated lung adenocarcinoma. On the top right here, we have some relatively normal lung. It's filled with these pigmented cells, which are all the crap that the person has been inhaling. These are macrophages filled with debris. But the normal lining, the air spaces of the lung, the alveoli, have very thin walls. Okay, you can barely see the cells on them. You see here that these alveolar walls are lined by these big, juicy-looking cells. You can clearly tell that it's still lung tissue, but these cells are also clearly abnormal. And so this is a well-differentiated lung cancer.
Okay. This is a poorly differentiated lung cancer. It looks like an abstract painting, essentially. There's no resemblance to underlying lung anymore. And if you encounter this kind of tumor in a lymph node, you're probably going to need to do stains to figure out where it came from. Atypia. It's just basically something that is irregular in appearance, usually in histologic appearance. Now, it's a critical point to remember that just because something's atypical doesn't mean it's cancer, doesn't mean it's malignant. There are lots of situations where tissue can look very, very atypical and be completely benign. So viral infections can do that. Chronic inflammation or an ulcer can do that. There's a lot of situations. People that have had radiation, it tends to make their cells look crazy, but they're still benign. Anaplasia is a loss, is a word that means loss of normal differentiation in form. So something that's anaplastic looks really, really atypical and really, really strange and ugly looking. Dysplasia is a very important concept for you to understand when you're doing research in cancer. Dysplasia generally we use to talk about the sequence of abnormalities that occur in epithelial linings as a progressive sequence towards carcinoma. So it's an abnormality in epithelial cell maturation and development. You notice it both because of the cell's architecture, how they're organized, and how they look individually, whether they're atypical or not. Okay? Usually we grade dysplasia. And we would grade it on the scale from mild dysplasia to moderate to severe. And I'll show some slides in a second. Dysplasia is pretty much by definition always atypical, but again, something that's atypical is not necessarily dysplastic, right? It could be radiation, virus, those things we talked about. Okay, so here's the inside of somebody's colon. They wash it out so that there's not all sorts of poop there. And we see this thing sticking off the wall. Okay, so that's a colon polyp. Now, there are lots of kinds of colon polyps. But one of the ones that we're looking for when you get your colonoscopy starting at age 50 is this kind of polyp, because this is a colonic adenoma. And these are, by definition, a form of colon lining dysplasia. So on the left here, we have normal colon lining, and it looks quite a bit like what we saw in Barrett's esophagus, right? We've got those pale blue-gray blobs in there. This is the mucus. But you notice that the cells are all small, or I mean the nuclei are all small, and they line up along where the basement membrane is. See how nice and organized that is? And how the nuclei are all very small and even. Then we get over here, and the nuclei get much bigger. And the whole thing looks darker because of that. The hematoxylin staining all those nuclei dark. So the nuclei are bigger. The mucus blobs, the goblet cells, those accumulations of mucus are gone in many areas because these cells are no longer maturing normally. They're piled up on each other. So they're disorganized, they're cytologically atypical. This is dysplasia. So the colon adenoma is a form of dysplasia. In this particular case, it's sort of a mildly dysplastic. But if you let this persist without treating it, it has potential to progress and become full-blown carcinoma. Here's another look at the colonic adenoma. Again, you can see how these nuclei are big and they're sort of piled and jumbled and they're not all lying nicely along the basement membrane anymore. We've lost all that mucus. Okay? Pleomorphism is a term that means variation in cellular size and shape. So it's kind of one of the things that defines atypia. If it's pleomorphic, it's atypical. And then a malignancy is something that is invasive and has metastatic capacity. Here are two examples of, they're sort of cousins. These are two types of neuroendocrine carcinoma of the lung. On the left, we have a carcinoid. This is a low-grade tumor that has minimal atypia. It's a carcinoma, but it's low-grade. You can see the nuclei are kind of even, about the same shape. On the right, we have small cell carcinoma. This is a high-grade neuroendocrine carcinoma. This is a very, very aggressive tumor. If you have a small cell carcinoma of the lung, your 5-year survival is quite poor. It has a tendency to metastasize early and often. It metastasizes to the brain. It's an aggressive tumor. So this is just two examples. One is pleomorphic, the small cell here. You can see that the nuclei, some are small, some are big. They're all kind of different shapes. And this one is not pleomorphic. They're all very unique.
Make sense? Another look at the small cell carcinoma. It's also got a bunch of mitotic figures, further evidence that it's very proliferative and a high-grade lesion. Okay, that's the definition. Do we have any questions about that? No? Pretty clear, right? I'm sure many of them you already knew. Okay. Let me drink some water. Then we'll talk about how the pathologist approaches a specimen grossly, so even before we get to the microscopy part. So there's a number of things that we look for when we get a specimen that we're going to gross, okay? And actually, at places like Roswell, the pathologists don't really do much of the grossing. We're around to help if there's a problem. Most of the grossing here at Roswell is done by our senior pathology assistants or by the pathology fellows who are in training. So it's done by trainees or pathology assistants. If you like this kind of thing and you don't want to go to medical school, pathology assistant is a good job. Well-paying job in short supply. Okay, so what do we look for? Well, we're looking for this. I guess this isn't the slide I thought it was. So what we're doing in a gross is we're dissecting the specimen and describing what we see. And we'll talk about what we look for in a second, I guess. And then one of the key things that they have to do is take pieces of that tissue, decide what part the pathologist needs to look at under the microscope. And then we do this part. Okay. Do we know what this is? What organ is this? It's not a finger. It's not a colon. It's a solid kind of thing, right?
Is that a heart?
No, not a heart. It looks like it could be muscle. It's the liver. Yes, this is a liver. And there's obviously part of this liver that's not normal. This round thing right here. So the pathologist would have got this chunk of liver from the surgeon because there's a tumor in it. And the pathologist then has measured the size of this chunk of liver, probably a lobe of liver, right? And then they've taken a very sharp knife and done what we call bread loafing, where you slice through it in these even sections that generally are about, you know, half a centimeter to a centimeter thick. So you have kind of a loaf of bread, except it's made out of liver. And that allows us to look very carefully at what's inside. And in one of those sections, one of those slices, we discover this tumor. So now what the pathologist has to do is make a bunch of measurements, gross measurements. Because these measurements can impact the stage of the tumor. Because for many tumors, the size of the tumor itself is an important staging parameter. So the pathologist would measure this and say, okay, whatever, it's four centimeters in greatest diameter. 4 by 3.5 by 3.5 centimeter tumor. They're going to measure how far it is from the margin. Now, the margin is where the surgeon cut through to remove it, right? So in this case, the margin is this kind of ragged edge here that's been cauterized during surgery. So they're going to measure that distance. Okay, it's 3.5 centimeters from the margin. That's important for the surgeon to know. If the margin's too small, they may have to go back and take more. If the margin's positive, if this tumor's touching it, they almost certainly will have to do something else, whether that's more surgery or radiation or something. So that distance is very important for the clinical team to know. The pathologist would also look at the borders of this, see if it's invading anything, if it's invading out through the outer part of the liver capsule. They'd look at the adjacent liver parenchyma. Does it look normal? Are there other tumors? Has this tumor spread elsewhere in the liver? These are all things that you do at the grossing bench. And then they decide whether they're going to take sections. Well, they're going to take sections from the tumor, obviously. They'd probably take sections, and when I say sections, this is what you're going to look at under the microscope. Then they take sections of the tumor and its interface with normal liver. They take sections from the margin to make sure there's no tumor that's hiding in there that we just don't see grossly and that the margin is truly negative like we think it is. Because if there's tumor on this margin, that means the surgeon didn't remove it all, right? And the intent of the surgery is almost always to remove the tumor if possible. And they take sections of the normal adjacent liver just to see if there's any underlying liver disease present. Does the patient have hepatitis C? Is there histologic evidence of that? Do they have steatohepatitis from being an alcoholic? You know, there's lots of things that you can learn just by looking at the grossly normal liver. So this is a hepatocellular carcinoma. It's derived from the hepatocytes of the liver. There are other types of primary carcinomas and tumors that can arise in the liver, but this is one of the more common. Okay, here's another specimen. What's this? What's that?
Colon.
Yes, colon. The tumor is not quite as obvious in this one, but it's actually right here. So now we have some polyps also, like we saw in the colonoscopy. We've got a few polyps. But the tumor itself is here. And it doesn't look like much because rather than growing out from the inside of the colon, right, this is the inside of the colon. So it's a tube, cut it open, laid it flat, washed all the goop off, and you're left with the inside here. So rather than growing out, this tumor is growing into the wall of the colon. So here the pathologist is going to do many of the same things. How big is this area of tumor? Look at how many polyps are there. How far is the tumor here from the margin where the surgeon cut through? Then the pathologist, in this case, is going to take sections through it like this, sort of cutting into the wall, bread loafing it, so that we can see how deep into the wall of the colon the tumor invades. That's critical to staging colon cancer. So we'll take sections for histologic review of the tumor, of the margin, probably this whole margin here to make sure tumor isn't sneaking up to the margin. Take sections of these polyps, normal colon. So this is a colonic adenocarcinoma. So we get the slides, or even when we're looking at the gross, we ask ourselves questions. Is there any pathology present? Occasionally, we'll get specimens that are entirely normal, either because of they sampled the wrong area, or they tried to do a biopsy and missed. And then, what is the nature of the pathology? Because although we're at a cancer center, and a lot of what we do here is cancer, you know, as a skin pathologist, I get quite a few samples from community dermatologists. And a lot of their specimens aren't cancer. They're patients with psoriasis, or they got a drug rash, or they got bitten by something in their lawn, and they've got a big itchy bump now, and they biopsy it. So I get a lot of non-cancer biopsies in my practice. So you ask yourself, is this an infection? Is it cancer? Is it some kind of other inflammatory or maybe an autoimmune process? Maybe this is a patient with a rash from lupus. But if it is cancer, so what do we need to collect now? Right, we figure out if it's a tumor, if it's neoplastic, is it benign or is it malignant? What's the type? Can we determine a grade, a stage, and has the surgeon removed it? So we've touched on this a little bit already when we talked about kind of different tumor types. There's epithelial tumors, mesenchymal, so carcinomas, sarcomas, tumors from blood cells, these are hematopoietic tumors, like lymphoma or leukemia. And there's tumors that are a mix, weird ones, carcinosarcomas and germ cell tumors. We're not going to talk about this in any detail, but just wanted to show sort of broad categories of cancer. And then we're supposed to go to 5, right? Yeah? Okay. I can't remember. I've done this 11 times. I don't remember how much more is on this, but we'll try and move fairly quickly because I think there's a bit left. Okay, epithelial tumors. So they tend to have names like this, adenoma, papilloma, or carcinoma, sort of depending on what the tumor type is like. Adenomas and papillomas tend to be benign. Carcinomas, as we know, are malignant. Carcinoma, malignant tumor of epithelium, right? There are different kinds. There's squamous cell carcinomas that are derived from squamous epithelium. There's adenocarcinomas that are derived from glandular or secretory epitheliums, like the adenocarcinoma of the lung we saw, or the adenocarcinoma of the colon we saw. Those are secretory or absorptive epithelium. There's neuroendocrine carcinomas, like that small cell carcinoma of the lung that we looked at. Neuroendocrine cells are a different type of epithelial cell. Often carcinomas are preceded by one of those pre-invasive lesions, the dysplasia we talked about. This is an adenocarcinoma of the lung. The normal lung, when it's fully inflated, doesn't look like this, but when the surgeon removes it, it kind of all collapses. So the lung tissue here, which is normally filled with air, has got this sort of purple, mushy look to it, and the tumor itself is this multilobulate tan thing here. Here's an example of dysplasia in the lung. It's an example of metaplasia then dysplasia. So this is the sequence we talk about in carcinoma, right? The dysplasia sequence. So your normal lung starts out like this. So you have these columnar cells. There's little hairs on the surface there. Those are the cilia. The normal lung has some mucus in it, those little goblet kind of cells. You smoke long enough, and you're damaging that epithelium, and you get a metaplastic response, right? So a protective response. So then, it's sort of the opposite of what happens in the esophagus. Instead of normal squamous being replaced by columnar epithelium, you have columnar being replaced by squamous. So patients that have long-term smoking histories, their epithelium changes to this kind of squamous epithelium as a protective response. But the carcinogens in the tobacco continue to damage those cells, and eventually they accumulate either a critical mutation or enough mutational burden that they become truly dysplastic, and you get this kind of very disorderly, it looks, if you think back to our colon adenoma, right, the nuclei are all jumbled and hyperchromatic, and they're not doing what they're supposed to do anymore, and that's kind of what's happened to this squamous epithelium. And then eventually, it just gets out of control completely and invades, and you have an invasive squamous carcinoma. One of the hallmarks that's useful to us as pathologists of carcinoma is, again, that they express cytokeratin intermediate filaments. Believe it or not, it's sometimes hard to tell whether something's a carcinoma or a sarcoma or a lymphoma. Treatment's totally different. So if we're trying to figure out if something's a carcinoma, before we do our CK7, CK20 panel or anything else, we'll just look to make sure there's CK there at all. And then we talked about how the expression profile of cytokeratin intermediate filaments can help us then decide what kind of carcinoma it is. Mesenchymal tumors, these are the omas and sarcomas derived from mesenchymal connective tissue. They're named based on what their presumed origin is. So a smooth muscle, when it's malignant, is a leiomyosarcoma. When it's benign, it's a leiomyoma, right? It's pretty easy to figure out. If it's blood vessels and it's malignant, it's angiosarcoma. If it's benign, it's an angioma or hemangioma. Here's a piece of somebody's humerus as an example of a sarcoma. This is the outer cortical bone, and then you have the marrow, the cancellous bone inside. Okay, again, this has been sliced through, this time with a bone saw. And you can see here that as the cortex of the bone comes along, it starts to get sort of lumpy and abnormal, and you get these sort of pale, glassy nodules wrecking the cortex focally and extending into the medullary part of the bone and the cancellous bone. So this is a chondrosarcoma. This is a malignant tumor of cartilage. And you can tell grossly that that's what this is with a fair amount of certainty just because of the look of the tumor. It's got this gray, sort of slightly wet, glassy look to it, which is very typical of cartilage. If you think about kind of like carving a turkey or something and bones have cartilage on the end, it has that same kind of look. So these mesenchymal tumors, they don't express cytokeratins generally. There are exceptions, but we're not going to go into that. But they tend to express another intermediate filament, vimentin. So that's useful. Although vimentin is a pretty promiscuous marker, you see it in a lot of different situations. Just like with different cytokeratin expression profiles helping you figure out what kind of carcinoma you're dealing with, you can use these other markers if you're trying to figure out what kind of sarcoma something is. Sarcoma pathology is extremely difficult and extremely complex. And there are all sorts of, big textbooks written on all the kinds of sarcoma. And so a lot of times we have to use a panel of immunohistochemical markers to figure out what kind of sarcoma something is. And even then, we can't figure it out fairly frequently. Unfortunately, now we've discovered that many sarcomas have reproducible cytogenetic abnormalities. So we can do fluorescence in situ hybridization testing, for example, to look for an EWS gene break apart or something that would define certain kinds of sarcoma, for example, right? So diagnosing sarcoma requires a combination of H&E morphology, clinical information, immunohistochemistry, and then fairly frequently, if not most of the time, cytogenetic information. The heme stuff, leukemias and lymphomas, kind of give me a headache. Lymphomas, broadly speaking, you have your T cell type, your B cell types, your NK cell types, and then there are other types also. But these are sort of the broad general categories. If there was a hematopathologist here, they'd probably be shaking their head in disgust at this slide. But I think for our purposes, it's good enough. T cell stain with cluster of differentiation 3, B cell stain with CD20, NK cell stain with CD56. So again, we're dealing with a population of malignant lymphocytes. We're going to have to figure out what antigens they're expressing to help us classify that lymphoma. And it's worth classifying these things, right? Because they have different prognoses. They may have different treatment regimens. Leukemias can be lymphoid or myeloid in origin. The difference between leukemia and lymphoma, right? Leukemia is a malignant proliferation of blood cells that's circulating in the blood primarily. Now, sometimes they'll settle and aggregate in a solid mass somewhere else, but primarily this is a circulating tumor. Whereas lymphomas are cells that involve either lymph nodes or other sources of lymphoid tissue and form discrete masses. Now, just like leukemias can settle and form tumors, lymphomas can also progress to a leukemic phase. But that's kind of the fundamental difference between a leukemia and a lymphoma. Here's a lymphoma of the lung. This mass, sheets and sheets and sheets of these small, slightly atypical white blood cells. You can kind of tell this is probably not a carcinoma because there's no architecture to it. The cells aren't forming any structures. Just sheets and nodules. So how do we know if we're looking at cells like that, or any cells, if we're looking at that hepatocellular carcinoma, how do we know if those cells are benign or malignant? How do we know it's not a benign tumor? Well, when I made this lecture 11 years ago, these were what I felt were the kind of key sort of parameters to look at. You look at the architecture of the tumor, sort of how are those cells arranged with respect to each other and the adjacent tissue. That tells you something about how they're behaving. I'm going to give examples. Proliferation. Are the cells proliferating rapidly? Benign things tend to be fairly low in their proliferation rate. Malignant things tend to be fairly high in their proliferation rate. When things are proliferating rapidly and the cellular machinery is really messed up, they have a tendency to undergo necrosis. And it could be necrosis just because the machinery of that cell is so messed up that they undergo spontaneous apoptosis. It can also be because the tumor is proliferating so rapidly it's outgrowing its blood supply and the cells are no longer getting enough oxygen. So you'll see necrosis in a tumor away from where the blood vessels are. So necrosis is generally a feature of something that's malignant when you're talking about a tumor. And then how the cells look. How do the nuclei look? How does the cytoplasm look? These are all important parameters to evaluate. Now, no single one of these is going to give you the answer. It's how they all combine. So, architecture. Does the tumor look like normal tissue? Is it nice and round, or is it irregular? Is it invading stuff? If it's invading stuff, it's more likely to be malignant. So here's a mammogram and a gross slice of a ductal carcinoma of the breast. And you can see, even grossly, this thing has an irregular contour, okay? It's not a nice, brown, circumscribed, smooth-bordered thing. And you can sort of see the same thing on the mammogram. This is normal breast tissue. This is the terminal ductal lobular unit. These little ducts branch out in a very organized way in the end, and each one of these lobules has a nice, round contour, okay? So this is nicely organized and circumscribed histologically, just like it would look quite normal grossly. Here's breast cancer. Here the cells are not nice and organized and lobular. They're growing into the fat. They're growing all around into the wall of this blood vessel here. There's some cancer cells there in the wall of the blood vessel. They're growing wherever they want. You look at this and you're going to say, yeah, that's malignant. Proliferation rate, well, one of the easiest things you can do is just count how many mitoses there are. How many mitoses are there in 10 fields of your microscope? The more there are, the more likely it is going to be malignant. And are the mitoses normal? Malignant tumors tend to have mitoses that are all messed up. The microtubules pulling the chromosomes apart are messed up, and so you get oddly shaped mitotic figures that are not following the nice kind of prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase pulling apart. They're pulling apart in four different directions at once. That's a sign of malignancy. And then we can use those markers like Ki-67 to just tell how many cells are in the proliferative phase of the cell cycle. We talked about necrosis. So here's a hepatocellular carcinoma. This is a liver tumor. Here's the normal cells at the top here. They look pretty ugly. And here, they're all dead. You can see this grungy debris. You can no longer recognize nice intact cells. So that's necrosis. This particular tumor is also mitosing like crazy. Each one of these stars is sitting beside a mitotic figure. They're all fairly normal, but it's very mitotic. And then the last parameter that we talked about is cytology, and this is the focus of cytopathology, right? And they're looking at pap smears, the fine needle aspirates, or brushings and washings. This is what they're focused on, because they don't have the advantage of all that other stuff necessarily. So cytology, what does the nucleus look like? Does it have a nice, smooth, even nuclear membrane? Is it irregular? Is the chromatin thick and clumpy, or is it nice and smooth and even? If there's a nucleolus present, is it huge and irregular, or is it small and inconspicuous? These are all kind of things that we look for. So one of these is benign, one is malignant. And the malignant one is the one on the left, number one, right? These nuclei are big. They have huge irregular nucleoli. They have nuclear membranes that are sort of bumpy and lumpy and variably thick. Here's benign liver. And the cells are very uniform, and they lack all of those features. Grading and staging. So the first few times I gave this lecture, this part confused people, and they got mad because of the questions on the test. So I've made an effort to, in the subsequent years, to make this as clear as possible. And I pretty much always put some kind of question about this on the test, because it's important. So grading, we touched on this earlier. It's based on the cytologic and architectural characteristics of the tumor, and the grade we're talking about here is a histologic grade. And you're trying to predict the future behavior. Like I said, something that's high grade or severely atypical or poorly differentiated, you're saying, I think this is going to behave in an aggressive fashion. And there are different generic systems that are used for many tumor types. And these are admittedly subjective. What one pathologist calls moderately differentiated, somebody else might say is moderate to poorly differentiated. It's not the definitions are not really clean in many tumor systems. But there are some very well-validated grading systems that you've probably heard about. For example, in the prostate, the Gleason grade is very reproducible. It provides all sorts of useful prognostic and treatment planning information to the clinicians. So when they get a prostate biopsy that has prostate cancer on it, the pathologist will give it a Gleason grade. The Gleason grade the system was developed by Dr. Gleason a long time ago. And I'm not going to go into the details, but essentially you're basing it on the architecture of the tumor gland. They go from being nicely circumscribed, but obviously malignant in grade 1, to being big irregular sheets with necrosis or just individual cells in Gleason grade 5. So these are the ones that are going to behave much more aggressively. So the high grade. And this is a very reproducible system. In the breast, there's a number of systems, but one is the Nottingham grade. And this is based on whether the tumor is forming nice glands or tubules, how ugly the nuclei are, how many mitotic figures there are, and you put it together as a score, again, nice and reproducible. Endometrium, there's something called the FIGO grade, based both on the architecture of the tumor and the nuclear features. Okay, so this is different from staging. Staging is a precise method to document the type and extent of tumor at a specific point in time. So this is separate from grade. You can have a low-stage, high-grade tumor. You can have a high-grade, low-stage tumor. They are completely independent things. They do have, in common, an attempt to try and estimate what the prognosis and behavior of something's going to be. So sometimes they can be at odds with each other. If something's high-grade but it's low-stage, Is it going to behave aggressively? I don't know. But staging is useful to also to plan treatment. So a lot of the treatment protocols that we follow here at Roswell are dependent on accurate staging. If the patient has an early stage lung cancer confined to the lobe of the lung with no spread anywhere else, the treatment is surgery. If they present and that same lung tumor has spread to their liver, surgery is no longer on the table as an option. That stage change has altered the entire treatment plan. It allows us to group similar patients for protocols, so you're not comparing the treatment efficacy of a chemotherapy in patients that have low stage disease with patients that have high stage disease. We know the patients that have high stage disease are probably going to die at a higher rate than the patients with low stage disease, even if they're both getting the same chemotherapy. So we want to compare similar groups of patients. Accurate staging facilitates that. Staging is performed according to guidelines that are published by a joint effort, the American Joint Committee on Cancer and the International Union Against Cancer. They publish a staging manual every few years. Currently, we're using the 7th edition, I believe, and the 8th edition will be coming out, taking effect next January. Staging system for every tumor type is different. Okay? So here's a melanoma. One of the key staging parameters for melanoma is how deep it invades into the skin. In this case, 3.1 millimeters. It's also important to know whether the surface of the skin is ulcerated. Okay, so I would document those things. I make this measurement, I document the ulceration.
Staging follows the TNM system. The T parameter is for the tumor, the primary tumor. So here's what the T parameters are for melanoma. This was a melanoma that was 3.1 millimeters. So okay, we're at a T3, and it had ulcer, so we're at a T3B. Okay?
Then we look and see if any of the lymph nodes are positive. Okay, none of the lymph nodes are positive, so it's N, well, I left it out, but it would be N0.
And we have no distant metastases. So we're at T3B, N0, M0.
So then we have the overall stage categories here.
Look it up. T3B, N0, M0. Okay, overall stage 2B. Now, it gets a little confusing because you've got these numbers and letters in the T, and you've got the overall Roman numeral numbers and letters there. But when clinicians say, oh, this patient is stage 3B, they're talking about these overall stage groups. Okay?
For melanoma, what stage you are says a lot about how well you're going to do. When you catch melanoma early, survivals are very good. You cut it out, hasn't spread yet, you're cured most of the time.
When melanoma has spread, stage 4, so we're down here where it's got positive lymph nodes and it's spread to other organs, M1, your survival at 5 years is, 10%. It's pretty dismal.
We're getting better at treating advanced stage melanoma. There's been a lot of exciting developments over the last 5 or so years, but it's still a very aggressive disease. And staging and prognosis is not necessarily the same between different tumor types either. A stage 1 esophageal cancer at 5 years in this chart, 30% survival at 5 years. For breast cancer, stage 1, 5 years survival, 95%.
So you can't really compare these curves between tumor types. They're different. Stage 1 breast cancer has got different survival than stage 1 esophageal or stage 1 melanoma or stage 1 colon. Okay, so for the last 10 minutes, any questions about that? Stage versus grade. Cool. Okay. Advances in pathology and pathology and research. So what we've talked about so far is the time-honored, time-proven, cheap and effective H&E immunohistochemistry approach to pathology. And like I said, you get a huge amount of information from those fairly modest tools. If you biopsy somebody's skin tumor today and I process it overnight, by tomorrow morning I can tell you if it's melanoma, whether you got it all out, how deep it is, give you some sense of what the prognosis is going to be, all of that overnight at a very inexpensive cost. But sometimes that's not enough. So more and more this traditional histopathology stuff is merging with molecular tools. Okay. It allows us to classify cancer on a molecular genetic basis, and we'll talk a bit about these.
It can help us find the primary site of metastasis. If your CK7, CK20 game fails you, and you still don't know where something is from, there are companies that market molecular tools to help you figure out where something's come from. You give them a chunk of tumor, and they'll give you back a report in a couple weeks that says, this has a 10% chance of being from the kidney, and a 25% chance of being from the colon, and a 75% chance of being from the breast. I've never found those reports very useful, but they're out there, and this is one of the ways that we can use molecular tools to help us with these kind of patients. Probably the leaders in classifying tumors using molecular tools were the hematopathologists in leukemias and lymphomas. And for a long time now, they've been classifying certain leukemias based not necessarily on how the cells look under the microscope or what stains they mark with, but in fact by what translocations are present, what cytogenetic abnormalities are present. These are all very discrete, distinct diseases with different courses, different chemotherapy sensitivities, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes you wonder, well, why don't we just all retire and we can group tumors by their genotype rather than by how they look under the microscope? This hasn't really panned out, but it's an interesting question that pops up now and then. I mean, there are a lot of tumors that are marked by a driver mutation in BRAF. Melanoma, many melanomas, it's a good example, but also colon cancers, a subset of lung cancers. And we have drugs that target cancers that have a BRAF mutation. So to some extent, it makes little sense to kind of group these together, ignore where they're from, what they look like. Just think about the driver mutation. The facts of life. All right, I think I just tacked this. This is a new slide for this year. Exciting. I showed this slide to some for a lecture I gave to surgeons a few weeks ago, and they enjoyed it. So disease really is a spectrum from black to white. It's a continuum, okay? Pathologists try and take these diseases and put them into categories. At one end, we have the benign stuff, or, you know, this is the benign stuff, and then we have the malignant stuff at the other end. Still, surgeons don't like that. They don't want you to say, well, you know, this is somewhere in between benign and malignant. It's this, you know, variant. They just like, okay, just tell me what to do here. Do I cut it out or do I leave it? Black and white. And we encounter this problem a lot in the pathology of cancer. Here's an example, and this is, you know, you're probably wondering where I'm going with this. This is, again, how molecular tools can help us in modern-day pathology. There are lesions where histopathology fails us, and there's a certain type of melanocytic lesion called a Spitz nevus. They tend to occur in children, and they're totally benign. But there are also lesions that look very similar that will kill you, Spitzoid melanomas. And then, of course, there's some that are in between. There are some that are just funny looking, but they're benign. There are some that are sort of like low-grade melanomas. They'll spread. They may not kill you. It's really hard to tell these apart. So we have to use other tools, and these are tools that have been used in this situation. We can look at the cells by genomic hybridization. You know, melanomas have lots of chromosome number abnormalities. Spitz nevi, when they're completely benign, have some abnormalities, but they're generally one at a time. They're of predictable groups. They can have kinase fusions or HRAS mutations. This was a very influential paper that came out about 3 or 4 years ago to answer this very specific problem. This problem has given me grief for years. You know, I've got a Spitz thing. Is it going to kill the patient or not kill the patient? I'm not sure. Well, they looked at fish to identify chromosomal copy numbers, and they found out that we could stratify these lesions by cytogenetic abnormalities. If the patient's Spitz tumor had a deletion that was homozygous of the 9P region, that was a tumor that was probably going to behave badly. Those were the patients most at risk of distant metastasis. Whereas if they had, you know, 6Q deletion, they're probably going to be fine. So here, the fish is a tremendously helpful supplement to the histopathology. I recognize it as a fish tumor. I do that in 5 seconds. And I study it and I say, well, I'm worried about this. It's funny looking. It's not just a completely benign Spitz nevus, but I'm not sure how bad it is. And they say, well, what do we tell the patient? What do we do next? Do we treat it like melanoma? Well, this kind of molecular tool can help us solve those problems. And then, of course, personalized therapy. This is a big thing. This is a big way that molecular tools help us now in planning treatment. Years ago, we discovered that lung adenocarcinoma has a number of driver mutations. It's not one disease. It's a bunch of diseases with different driver mutations. Many of these we can target therapeutically, so it's important to know what's driving a particular cancer. The classic, sort of one of the more common ones, is the epidermal growth factor receptor, right? So if it's turned on permanently by mutation, the kinase domains are phosphorylating these different cascades, and you're driving the tumor towards cell survival and proliferation, stuff you don't want to have happen. So they develop drugs to shut that down, erlotinib, gefitinib. Okay? So knowing that that mutation is driving the cancer is critical to planning treatment for that patient. When these drugs came out, the patients that discovered they had an EGFR mutation said they felt like they'd won the lottery because now they had a chance for an aggressive disease. And we worked that into our pathology protocols. Get a biopsy, you figure out it's an adenocarcinoma, and then you would do the mutation testing to see if that patient's one of the ones that won the lottery. Anybody know this guy? Yes. Carl Morrison. Carl is the CEO of OmniSeq. I don't know if you've heard of OmniSeq. Probably some of you have. Carl's a pathologist. He's in our department. He started OmniSeq, which is Roswell's personalized medicine spin-off corporation. This is taking personalized medicine to the highest level that we have available currently here. They have an OmniSeq comprehensive profile. So this is molecular sequencing. We give them a chunk of tumor. It doesn't even need to be very much. And they look at 144 genes. So a few years ago with lung cancer, we'd look at two or three. Now we just send it off, and we get reports on 144 genes on a small piece of tissue. Most of these, if not all of them, are targetable, either by current drugs that are chemotherapeutic agents or ones that are in the development pipeline from drug companies and others. His comprehensive assay looks for mutations, translocations, fusions, copy number changes, all of these things. This is what they're currently able to detect in the current form of this. So you can see there's the mutations with hotspot mutations, coding sequence abnormalities, genes that are gained in number, lost in number, and then a bunch of different fusions. Tremendously powerful. Not only can this help us find potential targets or multiple targets in a patient's tumor, sometimes it can even help us classify what kind of tumor it is, if it's a sarcoma or something, for example. Okay, it's almost 5. I'm sure you're completely sick of this and sick of me. So we're almost done. It's important to know the pathology resources that are available to you as researchers. Because we have the tissue and tissue all routes through pathology, we have to be organized and optimize procurement and storage of all of that. So tissue procurement is a big deal here at Roswell. A lot of that, actually, to his credit, was organized and pioneered again by Dr. Morrison. We have a pathology resource network that all of this information is available on the LIMS system. I don't know if you have access to it, probably, or your PIs would. For example, you can do a query and find out how many primary lung adenocarcinomas we have genomic DNA banked here at Roswell for use in your research. Now, to use that, of course, you have to go through the disease site research groups and get permission and all that kind of thing. But if you're just trying to sort of figure out what resources are available, the Pathology Resource Network has this kind of information. We also catalog all the procurement events so that we can make sure we're procuring tissue from all available tumors, because that's one of our goals. So we can find out when tumors come in, how big was the tumor, how much did we procure, where did it go, who got it. All of that is meticulously archived. We can give tissue fresh to your lab if you need for tissue culture or things like that. There's a lot of flash frozen tissue in our tissue bank. And the procurement team will also tell you whether the tumor that was procured is of good quality. All of that is documented too. Let's skip through these last few things. Tissue microarrays, let's just skip. Okay, so I gave you that paper to read, right? This is a new thing. You're probably wondering why the hell I thought you needed to know about myolipomas. Probably none of you even looked at it, or a select subset did. I picked this paper just because it's a classic example of a traditional histology pathology paper. Pathologists are very frequently the ones that
classify and discover new tumor types or new disease scenarios. And we do this in this kind of paper. This is written by Dr. Fletcher, who's probably the most famous, one of the most famous pathologists in the world. And he took a bunch of these tumors, many as he could find from all sorts of different hospitals, and meticulously categorized everything. How old was the patient? You know, all the clinical information. Were they male or were they female? Well, they're almost all female. That's an interesting finding. Where were the tumors found? Then we look at all the surgical characteristics. How big were they? Did the surgeon get it all out? Then they look at things like, how well did the patients do after the surgery? Did the tumor ever recur? This is all part of pathology, understanding the biology of the tumor. The details in this paper are not really important. I just wanted you to see a paper that kind of includes all that stuff. Look where this picture came from, Roswell Park. So we contributed to this series. And this paper talks about the gross findings. What do these tumors tend to look like? Before you cut into them, after you cut into them, what do the cut surfaces look like? All of this described in the paper. Of course they talk about the histology. What do they look like? They're a mix of fat, bland, spindled cells. What do they look like immunophenotypically? Oh, well, they stain with muscle markers, smooth muscle actin, desmin. And then, bringing it all the way up to modern day pathology, they talk, discuss, and characterize the molecular abnormalities in the tumor. So it's really just a very complete characterization. Now, sometimes these kind of papers are describing something that nobody's ever described before. Sometimes they were describing something that had just not been fully described in the past. They were anecdotal reports. So they pulled together the biggest series they could and characterized everything they could about them. And that's the study of disease. That's pathology, right? And that is the end at 5:01. All right, if you have any questions, please feel free to email me. If I don't answer, email me again. I sometimes forget.